Reyes said. Know that in doing this, you have moved against the Ghost Bloods in the most offensive of ways. We are now at war, Shallan.
You've always been at war, Shallan said. I've finally picked a side. Goodbye, Moraes. End contact.
The floating Spren molded into a globe instead of Moraes's face. Shallan sat back, trying not to feel overwhelmed. Whoever they are, Adolin said, we can handle them.
Ever optimistic? Well, he had good reason. With the leaders of the Honor Spren in disgrace, and lasting integrity open again to all who would visit, he had accomplished his mission. He'd been correct all along, both about the Honor Spren and about Shallan herself. Shallan reached forward and flipped to the next page in her notebook, where she'd done a drawing using Kallek's descriptions. It showed a pattern of stars in the sky and listed the many worlds among them. Shallan had kept her head down too long. It was time to soar. The listeners raised bows toward Venli as she walked up to their camp, alone, after insisting that the others stay back a few hundred feet. She didn't blame the listeners for turning weapons against her. They assumed she had come to finish the job she'd started. So she raised her hands and hummed to peace, waiting and waiting and waiting. Finally, Thud himself emerged from behind their fortification of piled rocks. Storms, it was good to see him. By the counts they'd done from the air, almost all of them must have made it through the narrows and out this side. 1,000 listener adults, along with many children. Thud approached, wearing war form, but he stopped short of striking range. Venli continued to stand and hum, feeling 100 bows focused on her. This eastern plain beyond the hills was a strange place, so open, and full of a surprising amount of grass.
Storms! Venli?
Thud turned to dash back behind the fortifications. She realized he must have just now seen her patterns. She was wearing a form he'd never known, so of course he hadn't recognized her from a distance. Thud! She called out, taking in enough stormlight to glow in the daylight. Thud! Please! He stopped, seeing her light.
Did my mother make it? She asked, longing. Is she alive?
She is, he called. But her mind is gone.
I think I might have a way to heal her.
Traitor, he shouted. You think I believe you? You would have had us killed.
I understand, she said softly to consolation. I deserve everything you can call me, and more. But I'm trying as I never did before. Please, listen to what I have to say.
He wavered, then crossed the stone to meet her.
Do the others know where we are? Does the enemy know?
I'm not sure, Venli said. The humans found you. One fused knew of you, but she is dead now. I don't know who she told.
What is a fused?
There's a lot you don't know, Venli said. Our gods have returned. Terrible as warned. I was largely responsible for this, even if Relaine says he's certain they would have found their way back anyway.
Thud perked up at Relaine's name.
We're going to have to do something to protect ourselves, Venli said. Something to make everyone leave us alone.
She held out her hand, and a little spren in the shape of a comet flew up from the grass and started circling it.
She's new to this realm, and a little confused, but she's seeking someone to bond and make into a radiant, like me and my friends.
You came to us last time with a spren who wanted a bond, Thud said to reprimand. And what happened?
This will be different, Venli said, alight with stormlight. I've changed. I promise you all the time you need to test my words, to decide without being pushed. For now, please let me see my mother. He hummed to Winds at last, a sign for her to follow as he started walking back to camp. Venli attuned joy.
There are more of these Spren that will make listeners into radiance? He asked.
Yes, she said.
How many?
Hundreds, she said. The rhythm of joy grew loud inside Venli as she entered the camp, though many who saw her hummed to anxiety. She cared for only one sight, an old singer woman sitting by a tent made from woven reeds. Venli's heart leaped, and the rhythm sounded more pure, more vibrant. Jaxlim really was alive. Venli rushed forward, collapsing to her knees before Jaxlim, feeling as if she were again a child, in the good way. Mother? She asked. Jaxlim looked up at her. There was no recognition in the old listener's eyes.
Without her, Thud said, stepping up beside Venli, we're losing the songs. Nobody else who knew them escaped.
It's all right, Venli said, wiping her tears. It's going to be all right. Timber within Venli let out a glorious song. Venli held out her hand, and the little light spren inched into the air, then began spinning around Venli's mother. The Reachers were searching for people who exemplified their ideal, freedom, and the listeners were the perfect representation. However, a radiant bond required volition, and her mother couldn't speak ideals, though the Reachers indicated that the start of the bonding process didn't require that. They also thought becoming radiant would heal her mother, though they couldn't say for certain. Mental wounds were difficult, they explained, and healing depended greatly on the individual. Jaxlim could still want this, couldn't she? She could still choose?
Listen, mother, Venli pled to peace. Hear me, please.
Venli began singing the Song of Mornings, the first song she'd learned, her mother's favorite. As she sang, listeners gathered around, lowering their weapons. They started humming rhythms to match hers. When she finished, Thud knelt beside her. The little spren had slipped into Jaxlim's body to seek her gem heart, but no change had happened yet. Venli took out a stormlight sphere, but her mother did not drink it in.
It was beautiful, Thud said. It's been too long since I heard one of the songs.
I will restore them to you, Venli whispered. If you'll have me. I understand completely if you won't. But I've brought other radiants with me. My friends, along with some of the enemy who have chosen to defect and become listeners.
Thud hummed to skepticism.
Again, if you turn me aside, that is understandable, Venli said. But at least listen to my friends. You're going to need allies to survive in this new world, a world of surge binders. We can't go alone as we did before.
We're not alone, Thud said. I think you'll find that things have changed for us, as they have for you.
Venli hummed to consideration. Then she heard a scraping sound, like rock on rock, or claws on rock. A shadow fell over Venli, and she started, staring up at a powerful long neck with a wicked arrowhead face on the end. A chasm fiend, here, and no one was panicking.
Storms. That's, she whispered. That's how you got out of the chasms that night? During the storm?
Thud hummed confidence. Before she could demand answers, something else interrupted her. A voice.
Venli? Venli? Is that you?
Venli looked down to see that her mother's eyes had focused, seeing her.
"Your words, Venli,"
a distant female in voice said in her mind,
"are now accepted."
116. Mercy. "Nearly as much as I look forward to serving you, newest Odium, who was so recently one of them, you understand. And you are the one I've been waiting to worship." Musings of El on the first of the final 10 days. Around 4 hours after Teft's funeral, Kaladin went looking for Dalinar. The Blackthorn had returned the previous night, but Kaladin had been too exhausted that evening to do more than salute him, then find his bed. So he excused himself from the party at Jor's winehouse and soared up toward the top of the tower. It felt good to fly up all on his own. Here, as reported by the messenger who'd brought him the news, Kaladin and Syl found the bondsmith, the Stormfather's bondsmith, taking reports with Navani, the other bondsmith. That was going to take some getting used to. Kaladin and Syl intended to linger outside the small council room until Dalinar finished his current meeting, but as soon as he saw them, he broke it off and came trotting over. "Kaladin," he said, "I've been meaning to speak with you." "You've been busy, sir," Kaladin said. He glanced down at his uniform. "Maybe I shouldn't be wearing this." Dalinar actually blushed. What a remarkable sight. "About that," he said, "I should have known I couldn't and shouldn't try to relieve someone like you from—" "Sir," Kaladin interrupted. He glanced at Syl, who nodded. He turned back to Dalinar. "Sir, you were right. I had a lot of healing to do before I should be in command again."
"Even still?" Dalinar asked, glancing at Kaladin's forehead and the missing brands. "After what you've accomplished? After swearing the fourth ideal?"
"The ideals don't fix us, sir," Kaladin said. "You know that. We have to fix ourselves. Perhaps with a little help." He saluted. "We were on the correct path with me, sir. I need to take time away from the battle. Maybe so much time that I never return to full command. I have work to do, helping men like me and Dabit. I'd like your permission to continue."
"Granted," Dalinar said. "You've grown, soldier. Few men have the wisdom to realize when they need help. Fewer still have the strength to go get it. Well done. Very well done."
"Thank you, sir," Kaladin said.
Dalinar hesitated. Something seemed to be troubling him. He put his hands behind his back, watching Kaladin. Everyone else was celebrating, not Dalinar.
"What is it, sir?" Kaladin asked.
"I haven't made it public knowledge yet, but Odium and I have set a time for our contest of champions."
"That's excellent," Kaladin said. "How long?"
10 days.
10 days?
Dalinar nodded. Syl gasped, and Kaladin felt a spike of alarm. He'd always kind of thought. He'd spent this year assuming that.
"Sir," Kaladin said, "I can't—"
"I know, son," Dalinar said quietly. "You weren't right for the champion job anyway. This is the sort of thing a man must do himself."
Kaladin felt cold. 10 days.
"The war. Does this mean it will be over?"
"One way or another, it will end," Dalinar said. "The terms will enforce a treaty in 10 days following the contest. The contest will decide the fate of Alethkar, among other items. Regardless, the hostilities will continue until that day, and so we must remain vigilant. I expect the enemy to make a play to capture what he can before the treaty finalizes borders. I perhaps made a miscalculation there. Regardless, an end is in sight.
but I'm going to need help from someone before this contest arrives. The fight won't simply be a sword fight. I can't explain what it will be. I don't know that I understand yet either, but I'm increasingly confident I need to master what I can of my powers.
I don't know if I can help with that, sir, Kaladin said. Though we share a surge, our abilities seem very different.
Yes, but there is one who can help me. Unfortunately, he's insane. And so, Kaladin, I do not need you as a soldier right now. I need you as a surgeon. You are of the few who personally understand what it means to have your own mind betray you. Would you be willing to go on a mission to recover this individual and find a way to help him, so he can help me?
Of course, sir, Kaladin said. Who is it?
The Herald Ishi, Dalinar said. Creator of the Oath Pact, Herald of Truth, and original binder of the Fused.
Syl whistled softly.
Sir, Kaladin said, feeling unnerved. 10 days isn't enough to help someone with ordinary battle shock. It will take years, if we can even find proper methods. To help a herald? Well, sir, their problems seem far beyond mine.
I know, soldier, Dalinar said. But I think Ishar's malady is supernatural in nature, and he gave me clues to help him recover. All I need from you now is an agreement to help, and a willingness to travel to Shinovar in somewhat, odd company.
Sir?
Kaladin asked. I'll explain later, Dalinar said. I need time to think this over, decide what I really want to do.
Kaladin nodded, but glanced at Syl, who whistled again.
10 days, she said. I guess it's happening.
Dalinar started back toward his meeting, then paused and reached for something on a nearby table. A flute? Wit's flute.
Lift had this, Dalinar said, handing it toward Kaladin. She said that Dabid recognized it as yours.
It is, Kaladin said with awe. How is Lift, by the way?
My lunch is gone, Dalinar said, so I'd say she's doing fine. We found her spren once the tower was restored, and they have, for some reason, decided to begin carrying around a bright red chicken.
He sighed.
Anyway, she said she found that flute in a merchant's bin down in the breakaway, one who sells salvage from the shattered plains. There might be other things your men were forced to abandon there.
Huh.
Did she say which merchant? Kaladin asked.
The pursuer drew in a deep, angry breath as he woke. Then he screamed in rage. It felt good to have lungs again. It felt good to shout his frustration. He would continue to scream it. Killed. A second time. By that Windrunner. That insolent mortal who thought his victory was due to his skill and not raw luck. The pursuer screamed again, glad for the sound to accompany his fury. His voice echoed. He was someplace dark, but enclosed. That made him pause. Shouldn't he be out in the storm?
Are you quite done, defeated one? A voice said in their language, but with no rhythm.
The pursuer sat up, twisting to look around.
Who dares call me?
He cut off as he saw who stood on the other side of the room, lit only by a void light sphere held casually in his hand. A sleek figure looking out a dark window, his back to the pursuer. The figure had twisting horns on his head and carapace that reflected the light wrong. He always ripped off his natural carapace formations at each rebirth, then replaced them with metal inclusions. They were incorporated into his body by void light healing and his own special talents. L, the one with no title. The pursuer silenced himself. He didn't fear this fused. He feared no one, but to L, he did not complain.
Where am I? The pursuer asked instead. Why have I been reborn so quickly? I was on Braze for barely a day before I felt the pull.
We didn't want to wait, El said softly, still facing away from the pursuer. No rhythms. El was forbidden rhythms.
So we had it done the old way, the way before the storms. I thought Odium wasn't doing that any longer. Our new god made an exception, defeated one.
The pursuer grunted, picking himself up off the ground.
They gave your title to another, you know, a human. I've heard. Disrespectful, the pursuer said to derision. It should have remained unused. Give me that void light. I need to recharge myself to earn back my legacy.
Earn back? The pursuer forced himself to keep his tone respectful, to not shout. The one with no title could be difficult.
I will hunt the mortal who killed me, the pursuer said. I will kill him and then anyone he ever loved. I will murder mortal after mortal until my vengeance is recognized, my atonement made. I assume you all know this if you couldn't wait for me to be reborn. So give me that damn void light.
El turned, smiling in the shadows.
It is for you, Lesion. Excellent, the pursuer said, stalking forward. But you mistook me, El said. When we said we did not want to have to wait for your rebirth, it was not your convenience that troubled us, but mine. I am very curious, you see, and you were the sole appropriate subject. Subject for what? The pursuer asked, reaching the window and looking out over Kolinar at night. Oh, to see if this really works. El raised the void light sphere, and the pursuer saw it was attached to a knife. Did the light look wrong somehow, warping the air around the gemstone? I think this might hurt, El said, then grabbed the pursuer by the front of his beard. Enjoy this final passion, defeated one.
He plunged the knife down as the pursuer struggled, and his soul ripped itself apart. Kaladin walked the now bright streets of the breakaway, bathed in cool, steady light from above. The transformation the tower had undergone already was amazing. The air had become as warm as it was in Aesir, an envelope of temperate weather that extended out to the fields. People breathed more easily now. The entire tower was not only properly ventilated, it had water running through hidden pipes into many rooms like they had in rich cities such as Carbranth. And that was just the beginning. While some rooms in the tower had once held normal wooden doors, many others had stone doors that opened to the touch. They hadn't realized how many rooms they'd missed while exploring because they'd been closed when the tower had last shut down. The place was truly a wonder. He finally found the merchant shop Lift had told Dalinar about. Though the hour was growing late, the market was busy with people celebrating, so a lot of the shops were open, this one included. Kaladin was directed to a bin of salvage, and he began rifling through it, Syl on his shoulder. He found Rock's razor, and some of Sigzil's brush pens, and he held up a miniature wooden horse carved in exacting detail. Syl breathed out an awed sound. I lost this before coming to the Shattered Plains, Kaladin said. I lost this in Alethkar. Tien gave it to me the day we were recruited into the army, and it was taken with my other things when I became a slave. How? He clutched the horse close to his chest. He was so amazed that he walked off and had to come running back to pay for what he'd taken. After that, he trotted back toward the tavern. He'd promised earlier that he would meet Dabid, Norl, and the others he'd rescued from the monastery sick rooms to decompress from yesterday's events. Kaladin would do as Dalinar asked,
and go to save the Herald Ishii. That was for tomorrow, however. Today, Kaladin had another promise to keep. After all, he'd told Teft he would join these meetings and start taking care of himself. Dalinar felt energized as he smelled the crisp, cool air of the mountains. He stood at the very top of the tower, drinking it in while holding Navani, her warmth pressed against him. The sun had set, and he'd had enough of reports for the day. He wanted time with his wife and to look at the stars.
"I should have known you'd find a way out of it on your own," he whispered to Navani as Noman bathed them in light. "I should have seen your potential."
She squeezed his arms.
"I didn't see it either. I spent a long time refusing to do so."
Dalinar heard a rumbling in his mind, not angry rumbling, though, more contemplative.
"The Stormfather doesn't know what to make of this," Dalinar said. "I think he finds it strange. Apparently his bondsmith and the Night Watcher's bondsmith sometimes had relationships, but the sibling's bondsmith was always apart."
"The sibling is curious that way," Navani said. "I'll introduce you once they are ready. It might take them time."
"As long as it's within 10 days, Dalinar said. "I can't guarantee what will happen after then."
"That deal you made," she said.
"I'm sorry. I had to make an agreement while I had him. It isn't everything we wanted, but..."
"It's a good deal, Dalinar," Navani said. "Inspired, even. We will have peace, even if we have to give up Alethkar. I think we've all been coming to realize that was a probability. Instead, this gives us a chance. I just wish that last bit you agreed to. That worries me."
He nodded.
"Yes," he whispered. "I know."
This was his job, though. To sacrifice himself, if need be, for everyone else. In that, Taravangian was right. It still felt so wrong for Taravangian to be dead. Dalinar would never have a chance to prove to Taravangian that Dalinar's way was correct. Gone. Without a farewell. Burned away in another stupid plot to manipulate Zeth.
"At least we can stop the bloodshed," Navani said. "Tell our troops to hold position and wait for the contest."
"Yes," Dalinar said.
Unless... Should Dalinar have insisted the contest happen sooner? He didn't feel ready, but would he ever?
"Something feels wrong," he thought. "Something has changed. We need to be ready for these next 10 days.
He felt that truth like a twisting in his stomach.
"I feel your tension," Navani said.
"I'm second-guessing what I've done," Dalinar said.
"The best information we have indicates this contest is our most reasonable hope of success," Navani said. "And I doubt anyone the enemy presents can best Stormblessed."
"I'm not going to pick Kaladin, Gemheart."
"Why?" Navani asked. "He's our best warrior."
"No," Dalinar said. "He's our best soldier. But even if he were in peak fighting shape, I don't think he'd be our best warrior. Or our best killer. Witt says the enemy can't violate our agreement, and isn't likely to try to misinterpret it, not intentionally. In fact, Witt seems to think the victory is already ours. But he got what he wanted. Odium will remain trapped either way. I'm worried, though. There's more I'm missing, I'm sure of it. At the very least, I think I left Odium too much room to continue fighting in the coming 10 days.
"We'll find the answers, Dalinar," Navani said. "We have a goal now. If we can win this contest, that will be enough. We will find a way to live in this new world, with the singers in their lands and humans in ours."
Navani squeezed his arm again, and he took a deep breath, intent on enjoying this moment. Storms, it felt good to be holding her. Beneath them, the tower's lights shone brightly in the night, and down in the corridors, it was positively warm. He'd had to come all the way up here to smell mountain air.
I should have known, Delanor repeated, about you.
I don't think so, Navani said. It was a remarkable stroke of luck that I figured it all out.
Not luck, Delanor said. Conviction, brilliance. I was scared for you, but should have remembered when I was scared of you, and realized how much danger the Fused were in by trying to take your fabrials from you. You are incredible. You've always been incredible.
She breathed out a long, contented sigh.
What? He said.
It's good to hear someone say that.
He held her for an extended moment of peace. But eventually, their crowns came calling. People came looking for Navani to settle something regarding the tower, and she was forced to leave. Delanor lingered on the top of the tower. He settled down on the edge, putting his legs over the side, the place where Kaladin had reportedly leapt into the darkness of the storm.
You were wise to give the Windrunner more time during his fall, the Stormfather said, approaching Delanor. You were wise to show mercy.
It's an important concept to learn, Delanor said to him. The more you study it, the more human you will become.
I do not wish to become human, the Stormfather said. But perhaps I can learn. Perhaps I can change.
That's all it takes, Delanor said. A willingness.
You are wrong, though. I do understand mercy. I have expressed it on occasion.
Really? Delanor said, curious. When?
117. One final gift. 14 months ago. Esh and I hit the ground of the chasm in a furious splash. Above, the battle for Narak continued, and the rest of the listeners summoned the Everstorm. She should be leading them. She was foremost among them. She leaped to her feet and shouted to a dozen horrible rhythms in a row, her voice echoing in the chasm. It did no good. She had been defeated by the human shard bearer, sent tumbling into the chasms. She needed to get out of here and find the fight again. She started trudging forward. Though the water came up to her waist, the flow was not swift. It was merely a constant, steady stream from the weeping, and in shardplate she was able to walk against the current, her greaves flooded with chill water. Which way was which? The lack of light confused her, but after a moment of thinking, she realized she was being silly. She didn't need to go either direction. She needed to go up. The fall must have dazed her more than she'd realized. She picked a rough-feeling section of wall and began clawing her way up. She managed to get halfway to the top, using the awesome gripping strength of shard plate, the rhythm of conceit pounding in her ears. But then the way the chasm wall bulged presented a problem. In the darkness, she couldn't find a proper handhold, and the flashes of lightning above were too brief to help. Lightning? Was that lightning too frequent, too bright, to be coming from other storm forms? Her own powers had been ruined by the water, naturally. She could barely feel any energy in her. It flooded out the moment it started to build. What was happening? That was the Everstorm coming, wasn't it? Yes, she could feel its power, its energy, its beauty. But there was something else. Listening to the howling wind, she realized what it was. A second storm. A high storm was coming as well. She attuned the rhythm of panic. The two storms clashed, making the very ground tremble. Clinging to the wall within the chasm, Esh and I felt the wind howling above. The lightning made her feel like she was blinking her eyes quickly, light and darkness alternating. Then she heard a roar. the terrible sound of water surging through the chasm, becoming an incredible wave. She braced herself, but when the water hit, it ripped her off the wall. It was here, within these high storm rainwaters, that Eshonai's first battle began, the fight for survival. She slammed into a rock, her helmet cracking. Escaping stormlight lit the dark waters as they filled her helmet, suffocating her. She thrashed in the current and managed to grab something hard, an enormous boulder lodged into the center of the chasm. With a heave, she pulled herself out of the water. A few precious moments later, her helmet emptied, letting her gasp for air. "I'm going to die," she thought, the rhythm of destruction pounding in her ears. Water thundered around her, splashing her armor, and lightning spasmed in the sky above. "I'm going to die as a slave." No. An ember within Eshonai came alive, the part of herself she'd reserved, the part that would not be contained, the part that made her let Thud and the others escape. It was the core of who she was, a person who had insisted on leaving the camps to explore, a person who had always longed to see what was over the next hill, a person who would not be held captive. That was when her second battle began. Eshonai screamed, trying to banish the rhythm of destruction. If she was to die here, she would die as herself. It was a high storm. In high storms, transformations came upon all people, listeners and humans alike. Within a high storm, death walked hand in hand with salvation, singing a harmony. Eshonai began summoning her blade, but in a rumbling flash, her boulder shifted and she lost her grip. The rhythm of panic ruled her briefly as she was again submerged. Lightning flashing above made the water seem to glow as she was smashed into one chasm wall, then another. "Not panic! Not your rhythms! I reject you! My life! My death! I will be free!" Sunken deep in the water, Eshonai summoned her blade and rammed it into the chasm wall. For some reason, she thought she could hear its voice, far away. Screaming? She clung to it anyway, holding steady before the current. She banished all rhythms, but she could not breathe. Darkness began to close in upon her. Her lungs stopped burning, as if everything was going to be all right. There, a tone, the strange haunting one she'd heard when taking war form. It seemed one of the pure tones of Roshar. It began a stately rhythm. Then a second tone, chaotic and angry, appeared beside it. The two drew closer, closer, then snapped together. They melded into harmony, making a song of honor and odium both. A song for a singer who could fight, but also for a soldier who wanted to lay down her sword. She found this tone as, in the blackness, a small spren, shaped like a shooting star, appeared ahead of her. Eshonai strained, reaching, clawing. Her head came above water, and then her helm blessedly emptied. The rush of the river was slowing. She gasped sweet air, but then her hand slipped from her sword, and she slipped back under the water and was towed away, though with less force than before. She attuned the rhythm of war, the rhythm of victories and losses, the rhythm of a life at its end. To its beats, she re-summoned her blade and rammed it into the ground, holding it tightly as the waters slowed further. She would not die. She would live. She was strong enough. Her journey was not at an end. Not yet. She held on, belligerent, until the water slowed, until the weight of her plate was enough to resist the current without her effort, and she slumped against the bottom of the chasm, her back to the wall, water streaming over her. She felt at her side, where the plate had broken, as had her body. She bled from a deep gash here, her carapace ripped away. Each breath came as a ragged, sodden mess, and she tasted blood. But in her mind, she cycled through the rhythms of her childhood. Awe, confidence, mourning, determination, then peace. She had lost the first battle, but she had won the second. And so, to the rhythm of victory, she closed her eyes and found herself drifting in a place full of light. What is this? Eshonai thought.
You were highly invested when you died, a voice said.
It rumbled with the sound of a thousand storms echoing through her.
So you persist for a short time.
Invested? Eshonai thought.
You were radiant when you died. You couldn't say the words under the water, but I accepted them anyway. How do you think you survived that long without breathing?
She floated. So, this is my soul?
Some would call it that, said the Rider of Storms. Some would say it is a spren, formed by the power you left, imprinted with your memories. Either way, this is the end. You will pass into eternity soon, and even I cannot see what is beyond.
How long? Eshonai asked.
Minutes, not hours.
She had no eyes to close, but she relaxed in the light, floating. She could hear the rhythms, all of them at once, with accompanying songs. What did it mean, then? She asked as she waited. Life.
Meaning is a thing of mortals, the rider said. It is not a thing of storms.
That's sad.
Is it? He asked. I should think it encouraging. Mortals search for meaning, so it is proper they should create it. You get to decide what it meant, Eshonai. What you meant.
If I decide, then I failed, she thought. I gave my people to the enemy. I died alone, defeated. I betrayed the gift of my ancestors. I am ashamed to all previous listeners.
I would think the opposite, the rider said. In the end, you made the same choice as your ancestors. You gave away power for freedom. You know those ancient listeners as few ever have, or ever will.
That gave her peace as she felt her essence begin to stretch, as if it were moving towards something distant. Thank you, she said to the rider.
I did nothing. I watched you fall and did not stop it.
The rain cannot stop the bloodshed, she said, fading. But it washes the world afterward anyway. Thank you.
I could have done more, the rider replied. Perhaps I should have.
It is enough.
No, he said. I can give you one final gift.
Eshonai stopped stretching, and instead found herself pulled toward something powerful. She had no eyes, but she suddenly had an awareness. The storm. She had become the storm. She felt every rumble of thunder as her heart beat.
Watch, the rider said. You wanted to know what was beyond the next hill? See them all.
She soared with him, enveloping the land, flying above it. Her rain bathed each and every hill, and the rider let her see the world with the eyes of a god. Everywhere the wind blew, she was. Everything the rain touched, she felt. Everything the lightning revealed, she knew. She flew for what felt like an eternity, sustained by the rider's own essence. She saw humans in infinite variety. She saw the captive Parshmen, but saw the hope for their freedom. She saw creatures, plants, chasms, mountains, snows. She passed it all, everything, the entire world. She saw it. Every little piece was a part of the rhythms. The world was the rhythms. And Eshenai, during that transcendent ride, understood how it fit together. It was wonderful. When the rider finished his passage, exhausted and limping as he passed into the ocean beyond Shinovar, she felt him let go. She faded, but this time she felt her soul vibrating. She understood the rhythms as no one ever could, without having seen the world as she had.
"Farewell, Eshenai," the Rider of Storms said. "Farewell, Radiant."
Bursting with songs, Eshenai let herself pass into the eternities, excited to discover what lay on the other side.
Epilogue. Dirty Tricks. Wit strolled the hallways of Elokar's old palace on the shattered plains, searching for an audience. He flipped a coin in the air, then caught it before snapping his hand forward and spreading his fingers to show that the coin had vanished. But of course, it was secretly in his other hand, palmed, hidden from sight. "Storytelling," he said to the hallway, "is essentially about cheating." He tucked the coin into his belt with a quick gesture, keeping up the flourishes of his other hand as a distraction. In a moment, he could present both hands empty before him. He added to the theatrics by pushing back his sleeves. "The challenge," he said, "is to make everyone believe you've lived 1,000 lives. Make them feel the pain you have not felt. Make them see the sights you have not seen, and make them know the truths that you have made up." The coin appeared in his hand, though he'd simply slipped it out of his belt again. He rolled it across his knuckles, then made it split into two, because it had always been two coins stuck together. He tossed those up, caught them, and then made them appear to be four, adding the two he'd been palming in his other hand. "You use the same dirty tricks for storytelling," Wit said, "as you do for fighting in an alley. Get someone looking the wrong direction so you can clock them across the face. Get them to anticipate a punch and brace themselves so you can reposition. Always hit them where they aren't prepared." With a flourish, he presented both hands forward, empty again. On his coat, Design made a peppy humming sound.
"I found one," she said, "in your belt."
"Hush," Wit said. "Let the audience be amazed."
"The audience?"
Wit nodded to the side, where a few odd spren were following in the air. Almost invisible and trailing red light. Wind spren, but the wrong color. She was expanding her influence, that old one was. He was curious where it would lead. Also horrified. But the two emotions were not mutually exclusive.
"I don't think they care about your tricks," Design said.
"Everyone cares about my tricks."
"But you can make the coins vanish with light weaving," she said. "So it doesn't matter how many you hide in your belt, and if you do something amazing, everyone will assume it was done with surge binding."
Wit sighed, tossing four coins in the air, then catching them and presenting one solitary coin.
"They don't even use those for money here," Design added, "so you'll only distract them. Use spheres."
"Spheres glow," Wit said, "and they're tough to palm."
"Excuses."
"My life is only excuses." He wound the coin around his knuckles.
The illusion without light weaving is superior design.
Because it's fake?
Because the audience knows it's fake, Wit said. When they watch and let themselves be amazed, they are joining in the illusion. They're giving you something vital, something powerful, something essential. Their belief. When you and the audience both start a performance knowing that a lie is going to be presented, their willing energy vibrates in tune with yours. It propels you. And when they walk away at the end, amazed but knowing they've been lied to, with their permission, the performance lingers in their minds. Because the lie was real somehow. Because they know that if they were to rip it apart, they could know how it was done. They realize there must have been flaws they could have caught, signs, secrets.
So it's better, Design said, because it's worse than an illusion using real magic?
Exactly.
That's stupid,
Wit sighed. He bounced his coin off the ground with a metallic pling, then caught it. Would you go bother someone else for a while?
Okay,
Design said excitedly. She moved off his coat and to the floor, then zipped away. His audience of corrupted windspren trailed after her. Traitors. Wit started down a side hallway, but then felt something. A tingling that made his breaths go wild. Ah, he thought. He'd been expecting this. It was why he had left the tower, after all. Odium couldn't find him there. He hiked to Elikar's former sitting room and made himself available, visible, easy to reach. Then, when the presence entered the nondescript stone chamber, Wit bowed.
Welcome, Rays, Wit said. It's been not nearly long enough.
I noticed your touch on the contract, a dramatic voice said in his head.
You've always been a clever one, Wit said. Was it my diction that clued you in, my keen bargaining abilities, or the fact that I included my name in the text?
What game do you play here?
A game of sense.
What?
Sense, Odium. The only kind I have is nonsense.
Well, and some sense. But scents are nonsense here, too, so we can ignore them.
Scents are mine aplenty, and you never cared for the ones I present. So instead, the sense that matters is the sense Delanar sensibly sent you.
I hate you.
Race, dear, Wit said. You're supposed to be an idiot. Say intelligent things like that too much, and I'll need to reevaluate. I know you adjusted the contract, trying for an advantage. How does it feel to know that Delanar bested you?
I shall have my vengeance, Odium said. Even if it takes an eternity, Sephandrius, I will destroy you.
Enjoy that,
Wit said, striding toward the door. Let me know how the brooding treats you. I spent a century doing it once, and I think it improved my complexion.
So interesting, Odium said. How did I never see you there in all my planning?
Tell me, whom would you pick as champion if you were in my place?
Why does it matter? Wit asked.
Humor me.
Wit cocked his head. There was something odd about this change in tone from Odium. Asking whom Wit would choose? Rays wouldn't care to know.
Never mind, Odium said quickly. It matters not. Whomever I pick, they will destroy Delanar's champion. Then I will use him and my minions on this planet to finally do whatever I wish.
Yes, but where will you find that many willing horses? Wit said, continuing on his way out the door. He started whistling as Odium's presence remained behind. That had gone exactly as he'd imagined, except that last part. He slowed, turning the words over in his mind. Was Ray's growing more thoughtful?
Wit didn't need to worry, did he? After all this, Odium would be safely imprisoned no matter what happened. There was no way out. Unless... Wit's breath caught, but then he forced himself to keep whistling and walking. A power slammed into him from behind. A golden energy, infinite and deadly. Wit's eyes went wide, and he gasped, sensing something horribly wrong about that power.
I have made an error, I see, the power said, soft and thoughtful. I am new to this. I should not have pushed for information. It's all about giving you what you expect. Even a being thousands of years old can be tricked. I know this from personal experience now.
Who are you? Wit whispered.
Odium, the power said. Let me see. I cannot harm you. But here, you have used this other investiture to store your memories, haven't you? Because you've lived longer than a mortal, should you need to put the excess memories somewhere. I can't see your mind, but I can see these, can't I?
For the first time in a long, long while, Wit felt true terror. If Odium destroyed the breaths that held his memories.
I don't believe this will cause you actual harm, Odium said. Yes, it seems my predecessor's agreements will allow me to...
Wit stopped in the hallways of Elokar's old palace on the Shattered Plains. He searched around, then cocked his head. Had he heard something? He shook his head and continued forward, looking for an audience. He flipped a coin in the air, then caught it before snapping his hand forward and spreading his fingers to show that the coin had vanished. But of course it was secretly in his other hand, palmed, hidden from sight. Storytelling, he said to the empty hallway, is essentially about cheating. He tucked the coin into his belt with a quick gesture, keeping up the flourishes of his other hand as a distraction. Then he heard a pling as something slipped free of his belt. He stopped and found one of his fake coins on the ground, the ones that could be stuck together to appear as one. But just one half? That should have been safely tucked away in the little pocket hidden in his shirt. He picked it up, glanced around to see that no one had noticed the mistake. "Pretend you didn't see that design," he said. But she wasn't there on his coat. Storming Spren, had she slipped away when he hadn't been looking? He put a hand to his head, feeling an odd disorientation. Something was wrong. But what?
The challenge, he said, tucking away the fake coin, is to make everyone believe you've lived 1,000 lives. Make them feel the pain, the sights, the truths.
Damn. It was wrong somehow. You use the same dirty tricks for storytelling, Wit whispered, as you do for fighting in an alley. Always be ready to hit them where they aren't prepared. But no one was listening. Hadn't there been a couple of Jeanette's minions following him earlier? He vaguely remembered design chasing them away? Wit stared around himself, but then felt something. A tingling that made his breaths go wild. Ah, he thought. He'd been expecting this. It was why he had left the tower. Odium couldn't find him there. He hiked the short distance to Elokar's former sitting room and made himself available, visible, easy to reach. Then, when the presence entered the nondescript stone chamber, Wit bowed.
Welcome, Rays, Wit said. It's been not nearly long enough. I noticed your touch on the contract, a dramatic voice said in his head. You've always been a clever one, Wit said. Was it my brilliant prose that clued you in, my keen bargaining abilities, or the fact that I included my name right there for you to read?
What game do you play here?
A game of sense.
What?
Sense, Odium, the only kind I have is nonsense. Well, and some sense.
He glanced down at the coin he still held in his hand, then cocked his head.
I hate you.
Raise, Wit said, looking up. You're supposed to be an idiot. Say intelligent things like that too much, and I'll need to reevaluate. Anyway, I know you adjusted the contract, trying for an advantage. How does it feel to know that Dalinar Kolin, a simple mortal, has gotten the better of you?
I shall have my vengeance, Odium said. Even if it takes an eternity, Sephandrius, I will destroy you.
Enjoy that, Wit said, striding toward the door. Let me know how you enjoy the time with yourself. The Beyond knows no one else can stand your company.
It doesn't matter, Odium roared. My champion will destroy Dalinar's, and then I will use him and my other minions here to do whatever I wish.
Yes, well, Wit said from the door. Once you're done, at least try to remember to wash your hands.
He slammed the door, then spun and continued on his way. He tried to find a tune to whistle, but each one sounded wrong. Something was fiddling with his perfect pitch. Odium's presence had remained behind. Was something wrong?
Don't trouble yourself, he thought. This is working.
After all, Wit's first face-to-face meeting with Odium in over 1,000 years had gone exactly as he had imagined. The end of Book 4 of The Stormlight Archive. End note. Burdens, our calling. Songs of home, a knowledge. Knowing a home of songs called our burden. Ketic, written by L, fused scholar of human art forms, to commemorate the restoration of the sibling. Poem is curious in its intentional waiting of the last line, where Alethi poets traditionally wait the center word and build the poem around it. Singers, it can be seen, have a different interpretation of the art form.
Ars Arcanum. The 10 essences and their historical associations. 1. Yes, gemstone, sapphire, essence, zephyr, body focus, inhalation. Soul casting properties, translucent gas, air. Primary and secondary divine attributes, protecting, leading. 2. Non, gemstone, smokestone, essence, vapor, body focus, exhalation. Soul casting properties, opaque gas, smoke, fog. Primary and secondary divine attributes, just, confident. 3. Chach, gemstone, ruby, essence, spark, body focus, the soul. Soul casting properties, fire. Primary and secondary divine attributes, brave, obedient. 4. Vev, gemstone, diamond, essence, lucentia, body focus, the eyes. Soul casting properties, quartz, glass, crystal. Primary and secondary divine attributes, loving, healing. 5. Pala, gemstone, emerald, essence, pulp, body focus, the hair. Soul casting properties, wood, plants, moss. Primary and secondary divine attributes, learned, giving. 6. Shash, gemstone, garnet, essence, blood, body focus, the blood. Soul casting properties, blood, all non-oil liquid. Primary and secondary divine attributes, creative, honest. 7. Betab, gemstone, zircon, essence, tallow, body focus, oil, soul casting properties, all kinds of oil, primary and secondary divine attributes, wise, careful. 8. Cock, gemstone, amethyst, essence, foil, body focus, the nails, soul casting properties, metal, primary and secondary divine attributes, resolute, builder. 9. Tanat, gemstone, topaz, essence, talus, body focus, the bone, soul casting properties, rock and stone, primary and secondary divine attributes, dependable, resourceful. 10. Ishi, gemstone, heliodor, essence, sinew, body focus, flesh, soul casting properties, meats, flesh, primary and secondary divine attributes, pious, guiding. The preceding list is an imperfect gathering of traditional Voron symbolism associated with the 10 essences. Bound together, these form the double eye of the Almighty, an eye with two pupils representing the creation of plants and creatures. This is also the basis for the hourglass shape that was often associated with the night's radiant. Ancient scholars also placed the 10 orders of Knights Radiant on this list, alongside the heralds themselves, who each had a classical association with one of the numbers and essences. I'm not certain yet how the 10 levels of void binding, or its cousin, the old magic, fit into this paradigm, if indeed they can. My research suggests that indeed there should be another series of abilities that is even more esoteric than the void bindings. Perhaps the old magic fits into those, though I am beginning to suspect that it is something entirely different. Note that I currently believe the concept of the body focus to be more a matter of philosophical interpretation than an actual attribute of this investiture and its manifestations. The 10 surges. As a complement to the essences, the classical elements celebrated on Roshar are found the 10 surges. These, thought to be the fundamental forces by which the world operates, are more accurately a representation of the 10 basic abilities offered to the heralds and then the Knights Radiant by their bonds. Adhesion, the surge of pressure and vacuum. Gravitation, the surge of gravity. Division, the surge of destruction and decay. Abrasion, the surge of friction. Progression, the surge of growth and healing, or regrowth. Illumination, the surge of light, sound, and various waveforms. Transformation, the surge of soul casting. Transportation, the surge of motion and realmatic transition. Cohesion, the surge of strong axial interconnection. Tension, the surge of soft axial interconnection. On the creation of fabrials. 5 groupings of fabrials have been discovered so far. The methods of their creation are carefully guarded by the Artifabrian community, but they appear to be the work of dedicated scientists, as opposed to the more mystical surge bindings once performed by the Knights Radiant. I am more and more convinced that the creation of these devices requires forced enslavement of transformative cognitive entities, known as spren, to the local communities. Altering fabrials. Augmenters. These fabrials are crafted to enhance something. They can create heat, pain, or even a calm wind, for instance. They are powered, like all fabrials, by stormlight. They seem to work best with forces, emotions, or sensations. The so-called half-shards of Yakeved are created with this type of fabrial attached to a sheet of metal, enhancing its durability. I have seen fabrials of this type crafted using many different types of gemstone. I am guessing that any one of the 10 pole stones will work. Diminishers. These fabrials do the opposite of what augmenters do, and generally seem to fall under the same restrictions as their cousins. Those artifabrians who have taken me into confidence seem to believe that even greater fabrials are possible than what have been created so far, particularly in regard to augmenters and diminishers. Pairing fabrials. Conjoiners. By infusing a ruby and using methodology that has not been revealed to me, though I have my suspicions, you can create a conjoined pair of gemstones. The process requires splitting the original ruby. The two halves will then create parallel reactions across a distance. Span reeds are one of the most common forms of this type of fabrial. Conservation of force is maintained. For instance, if one is attached to a heavy stone, you will need the same strength to lift the conjoined fabrial that you would need to lift the stone itself. There appears to be some sort of process used during the creation of the fabrial that influences how far apart the two halves can go and still produce an effect. Reversers. Using an amethyst instead of a ruby also creates conjoined halves of a gemstone, but these two work in creating opposite reactions. Raise one, and the other will be pressed downward, for instance. These fabrials have only just been discovered, and already the possibilities for exploitation are being conjectured. There appear to be some unexpected limitations to this form of fabrial, though I have not been able to discover what they are. Warning fabrials. There is only one type of fabrial in this set, informally known as the alerter. An alerter can warn one of a nearby object, feeling, sensation, or phenomenon. These fabrials use a heliodor stone as their focus. I do not know whether this is the only type of gemstone that will work, or if there is another reason heliodor is used. In the case of this kind of fabrial, the amount of stormlight you can infuse into it affects its range. Hence, the size of gemstone used is very important. Windrunning and lashings. Reports of the assassin in White's odd abilities have led me to some sources of information that, I believe, are generally unknown. The Windrunners were an order of the Knights Radiant, and they made use of two primary types of surge binding. The effects of these surge bindings were known, colloquially among the members of the order, as the three lashings. Basic lashing, gravitational change. This type of lashing was one of the most commonly used lashings among the order, though it was not the easiest to use. That distinction belongs to the full lashing below. A basic lashing involved revoking a being's or object's spiritual gravitational bond to the planet below, instead temporarily linking that being or object to a different object or direction. Effectively, this creates a change in gravitational pull, twisting the energies of the planet itself. A basic lashing allowed a windrunner to run up walls, to send objects or people flying off into the air, or to create similar effects. Advanced uses of this type of lashing would allow a windrunner to make himself or herself lighter by binding part of his or her mass upward. Mathematically, binding a quarter of one's mass upward would halve a person's effective weight. Binding half of one's mass upward would create weightlessness. Multiple basic lashings could also pull an object or a person's body downward at double, triple, or other multiples of its weight. Full lashing, binding objects together. A full lashing might seem very similar to a basic lashing, but they worked on very different principles. While one had to do with gravitation, the other had to do with the force, or surge, as the Radiants called them, of adhesion, binding objects together as if they were one. I believe this surge may have had something to do with atmospheric pressure. To create a full lashing, a windrunner would infuse an object with stormlight, then press another object to it. The two objects would become bound together with an extremely powerful bond, nearly impossible to break. In fact, most materials would themselves break before the bond holding them together would. Reverse lashing, giving an object a gravitational pull. I believe this may actually be a specialized version of the basic lashing. This type of lashing required the least amount of stormlight of any of the three lashings. The windrunner would infuse something, give a mental command, and create a pull to the object that yanked other objects toward it. At its heart, this lashing created a bubble around the object that imitated its spiritual link to the ground beneath it. As such, it was much harder for the lashing to affect objects touching the ground, where their link to the planet was strongest. Objects falling or in flight were the easiest to influence. Other objects could be affected, but the stormlight and skill required were much more substantial. Light weaving. A second form of surge binding involves the manipulation of light and sound in illusory tactics common throughout the Cosmere. Unlike the variations present on Cell, however, this method has a powerful spiritual element, requiring not just a full mental picture of the intended creation, but some level of connection to it as well. The illusion is based not simply upon what the light weaver imagines, but upon what they desire to create. In many ways, this is the most similar ability to the original Yolish variant, which excites me. I wish to delve more into this ability, with the hope to gain a full understanding of how it relates to cognitive and spiritual attributes. Soul casting. Essential to the economy of Roshar is the art of soul casting, in which one form of matter is directly transformed into another by changing its spiritual nature. This is performed on Roshar via the use of devices known as soul casters, and these devices, the majority of which appear to be focused on turning stone into grain or flesh, are used to provide mobile supply for armies or to augment local urban food stores. This has allowed kingdoms on Roshar, where fresh water is rarely an issue because of high storm rains, to field armies in ways that would be unthinkable elsewhere. What intrigues me most about soul casting, however, are the things we can infer about the world and investiture from it. For example, certain gemstones are requisite in producing certain results. If you wish to produce grain, your soul caster must both be attuned to that transformation and have an emerald, not a different gemstone, attached. This creates an economy based on the relative values of what the gemstones can create, not upon their rarity. Indeed, as the chemical structures are identical for several of these gemstone varieties, aside from trace impurities, the color is the most important part, not their actual axial makeup. I'm certain you will find this relevance of hue quite intriguing, particularly in its relationship to other forms of investiture. This relationship must have been essential in the local creation of the table I've included above, which lacks some scientific merit, but is intrinsically tied to the folklore surrounding soul casting. An emerald can be used to create food, and thus is traditionally associated with a similar essence. Indeed, on Roshar there are considered to be 10 elements, not the traditional 4 or 16, depending upon local tradition. Curiously, these gemstones seem tied to the original abilities of the soul casters who were an Order of Knights Radiant, but they don't seem essential to the actual operation of the investiture when performed by a living radiant. I do not know the connection here, though it implies something valuable. Soulcasters, the devices, were created to imitate the abilities of the surge of soul casting, or transformation. This is yet another mechanical imitation of something once available only to a select few within the bounds of an invested art. The honor blades on Roshar, indeed, may be the very first example of this, from thousands of years ago. I believe this has relevance to the discoveries being made on Scadrial and the commoditization of allomancy and ferrochemy. Stone shaping. As I've had further occasion to study the use of investiture on Roshar and the curious manifestation of it known as surge binding, I've found occasion to ruminate further on the nature of intent and connection. The power known as stone shaping, as practiced by the orders of stone wards and will shapers, is an excellent example of this. This ability manipulates the surge of cohesion, and is in many ways a cousin to the axial manipulation known as microkinesis, as both grant the ability to manipulate the forces that bind individual axes together. Fortunately, in my explorations, it appears that stone shaping is far less explosive of a power, bounded by the rules that honor placed upon it to protect from the mistakes that happened on Yolan. Nevertheless, a practiced stone ward or will shaper can mold stone as if it were clay, weakening the bonds between axes. Indeed, this can be done to other materials as well, I'm led to believe, but stone is the easiest and most common application. This is not simply a chemical process. Normally, one might expect heat to be involved to excite the axis, but this is not the case. Indeed, it is the intent of the user that is relevant here. The stone senses the desire of the stone ward, and the practitioner is able to shape it through desire as much as through physical force. I don't believe I properly understood the way investiture responds to the conscious intent of the user until I read of the interactions of Spren and sapient beings on Roshar. There is so much to learn here, and so much to explore. I have sent my best agent to embed among the stone wards. His research has been most illuminating. It suggests there are three ways we can look at the nature of intent as it relates to stone shaping. Willingness. Stone seems to be uniformly willing to obey the commands of a surge binder attuned to cohesion. This is curious, as stone is often among the most difficult of materials to work with in soul casting, even more difficult than living beings, depending on those beings' emotional, mental, and spiritual states. Why is stone so eager to change for a stone ward or will shaper? What about it makes it so likely to respond to their desires, to incorporate them, and to enjoy the result? Like a willing audience at a comedy, the stone lets the surge binder guide it. Connection. The stone can sense the intent of the surge binder, and even their past. I have reliable reports of stone reaching back through generations of connection to display events, feelings, emotions, and ideas from long ago. It will shape the faces of stone wards long dead. It will create pictures of events long forgotten. What I initially dismissed as an inferior form of microkinesis is indeed much more focused and, in some ways, more remarkable. There is a divining property to stone shaping I had not thought to find. Command. The stone shaper must often make a command, mental or verbal, to truly control the stone. This is much like many other arcana around the Cosmere, and is in itself not that novel. However, I find electrifying the news out of the mountains of Ur that their current queen seems to have been able to command the creation of an anti-investiture. Long theorized, this will be my first true evidence it is possible and can only be created through intent. I think that perhaps Foyle, deep within his ocean, would find this information supports my theories over his. And he'd do well to listen to me on this matter, if he ever wishes to achieve control over the ethers, as he has insisted is his goal.
We hope you've enjoyed this production of Rhythm of War, Book 4 of the Stormlight Archive, a Macmillan audio production for Tor Books. This title was produced by Steve Wagner, post-production by Listen Up Audiobooks. Text copyright 2020, Brandon Sanderson. Production copyright 2020 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.